I used to be the man with no control. You know what I mean? Like, who's holding, where's the babes, and what's happening after the show, you know? And I just started turning things around, you know? You know, your career gets a lot better when people threaten to fire you. All I know is I woke up, you know, with tubes coming out of me, and I tried to crawl out of the hospital, and then the doctors told me I was never going to walk again. Hi, gang, this is Money Man. That's right, Eddie Money, in the studio for No Control.
And no doubt you've seen or heard about the television commercial for an auto insurance company featuring veteran rock singer Eddie Money as a fictitious travel agency owner doing his best Rodney Dangerfield as Al Chervik in Caddyshack impersonation, all the while singing Eddie's hit Two Tickets to Paradise to a family of four who want to leave on vacation. It's pretty funny. The outside facade of the make-believe Eddie Money travel office is so realistic that the internet is abuzz with speculation that it's real. Now, it's true that the real-life Edward Joseph Mahoney has done a lot of things in his life, including mugging for the camera in various TV sitcoms over the years. But singing was, is, and always will be his ticket. Here's Eddie Money with me in the studio.
You know, I mean, I've always been a sucker for a good love song, ever since people like Otis Redding and John Lennon. And I write a lot of love songs. I write a lot of tunes about fast cars, and I write a lot of tunes about, you know, in and out of trouble. And basically speaking, I think my concept of writing, I write songs that people can relate to. I mean, I write songs like, everybody would love to have Two Tickets to Paradise. Everybody would love to take somebody home tonight. Everybody's always ran off with some girl who's got her father's car and blew out the speakers, like, shaking. And everybody's had endless nights, you know? And I think that the most important thing, I think the most gratifying thing that an artist can have is to write a song, or to take a lousy demo and transpose that song into something that people can relate with. When people say, I know what he's talking about, that to me is the greatest feeling in the world. I'm not in this business for money. You know, I mean, money has always been, I've always got money. It's always come my way. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't need a lot. I'm not the kind of guy that drives around in a Ferrari. I'm not the kind of guy that needs a swimming pool the size of Disneyland. You know, that's not what I want out of life.
Wait.
Money's Two Tickets to Paradise appears on his 1977 debut.
I grew up in Brooklyn, Redbeard. I grew up basically on the streets of Brooklyn. My father was a cop. I used to have kind of long hair. I used to wear tight pants. I used to have to be the first one over the fence because if I got caught, you know, I'd be a dead man. And I listened to a lot of music. I grew up with people like early Elvis Presley, Little Richard, Jerry Lee Lewis. You know, this when I was very, very little. And then I went through that white period with Frankie Avalon and Pat Boone. And that's when I started listening to people like James Brown and started listening to people like Sam and Dave and people like that. I grew up with a lot of black music in my life. Well, I had a great uncle. He passed away. He was a real sweetheart. Drank like a fish, but he loved rock and roll, you know? And he turned me on to Elvis Presley. And before I know it, I was doing Elvis Presley imitations at all my relatives' parties. And my father would flip out. But, you know, everybody used to just love the way, you know, to, you know, shake my hits and do Hound Dog and All Shook Up and things like that. And I would just, you know, to mesmerize other little people, especially little girls, I thought that was the greatest thing in the world, you know. And then I joined the rock band when I was in fifth grade. I mean, I was in a rock band before the Beatles came out. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? I was way before the Beatles came out. I was singing rock. You know, I was doing Chuck Berry tunes and I was doing James Brown and you know, Otis Redding and stuff like that. And it was really wonderful. And then when the Beatles came out, everything really exploded. And it was just the greatest thing in the world, because when I was a kid, I never used to have a paper route. I never had to work in the grocery store. I never had to bag groceries and things like that. I used to sing rock and roll in like, you know, the Knights of Columbus halls. And then in junior high school and high school, I was always in the battle of the bands and things like that. And I always made my money singing until I got my driver's license and started wrecking my father's cars. Then I had six or seven jobs besides being in a rock band to pay for the cars I was wrecking, you know. But I've always been in music ever since I was as a kid, because I grew up in New York City. I grew up with shows like Damn Yankees. I grew up with a lot of Broadway musicals. And my sister, I have three younger sisters than me. And I was always, you know, I always took the lead. You know, they were always my background. They were always the background singers for me, you know, ever since I was a kid, because my sisters have pretty good voices. And I've always been into rock, man. You know, I tell you, what I really regret is when I was in fifth and sixth grade, if I would have held on to some of those original Les Paul guitars that my buddies were using, or some of those old Stratocasters, I'm talking about like, you know, 1961, 60, maybe 58, 59. God, can you imagine the money I would have made? Well, actually, I was growing up in Brooklyn. Then I went to high school in Brooklyn, and I started getting really crazy. I started, you know, running around a lot of Italian girls and sniffing glue and, you know, really getting out there. But the first year I was in school, I was doing great. And then the second year in school, I found out what a duplicate report card was. So I came home with the greatest marks in the world without ever going to school. So then my old man got wind of that. And, you know, I was definitely heading for either reform school or a very prominent career in the can. So we moved out to Levittown, Long Island. And when I was out there, that's when I joined the band, and that's when the Beatles were becoming very popular. And I joined a rock group out there that was a lot different, because then I became, you know, it was very white orientated, so to speak, you know. I wasn't doing a lot of James Brown, a lot of Otis Redding. I wasn't doing old Sam Cooke, stuff like that. Then I joined the band, and we became very popular. We had a group called the Grapes of Wrath. You know, we used to play with the Hassles, which was Billy Joel's band, right, out there in Long Island. You know, as a matter of fact, I was in a band battle with Billy Joel, wow, and we won. This was a long, long time ago. And then when I graduated from high school, I joined the police department because, basically speaking, I was also doing a lot of surfing at the time. I used to love to surf. And I was a little bit more collegiate than the band. The band was dressed up in their greasy the Beetle boots and the Nehru jackets. And I just thought they looked like a bunch of, you know, light on the wrist end, you know? So I was more like, you know, I was into jeans and I was into penny loafers with no socks. And my hair was long, but it was more like a surfer cut. And anyway, I really wanted to do something else. I was like, you know, I got my letter playing soccer. I ran track in high school. You know, I was on the wrestling team. I did a lot of things they didn't do, you know. And then when we graduated, I was getting tired of playing rock and roll, because we almost had a deal with a guy named Joe Cavallero. This was back in oh God, it was 1965. And we actually went into the Joe Cavaletto studio and we rehearsed on the Rolling Stones equipment. The Rolling Stones were doing a tour in New York, and everybody was, I was in shock. I couldn't believe it, because I was just a kid. And here I was practicing, auditioning my band for where the Rolling Stones, on their rented equipment. Now, this guy, Joe Cavaliero, liked me, but he didn't like the band. And I couldn't figure that out, because we were very close-knit unit, and you know, without, I was never gonna do anything without the band. And when he passed on us, I was very disappointed with rock and roll. And I decided to go on to the police department basically to, you know, to serve the people, you know, to, if somebody was going to get their purse ripped off, I'd try to get it back. If somebody was going to jump out a window, I'd try to stop them. Or, you know, if somebody had a lady was pregnant, I could see myself delivering a baby in a taxi cab. You know, I mean, it was, I joined the police department not to bust people, not to scare, not to be on a power trip. I joined the police department, you know, to serve the people, actually. Just like my father really never gave a black man a ticket the whole time he was on the police department, because he knew that black people didn't have money. That's the kind of cop he was, you know? And I went on the police department, and I kept playing with my band, and all of a sudden, everything got really political, and the guys in the band didn't want a pig in the band, if you can believe that. And they were anti-me because they were anti-police, you know? And that kind of really hurt my feelings tremendously. And they all moved out to California. So when they moved out to California, I was getting very bored on the police department, because I took typing in high school because I got thrown out of shop class for fighting with the shop teacher. So I wound up taking typing in an all-girls class because I needed the credit to graduate. It was very embarrassing to have my friends come by and knock on the window and tease the heck out of me, you know? But when I went on the police department, they said, can anybody type? And I said, geez, I can't. So I raised my hand. So I wound up typing the roll calls. So when people ask me, I tell people I had a very dangerous job on the police department. I worked undercover. They said, really, what'd you do? I said, I was an undercover typist. So I was doing that for about a year. And then, you know, I was seeing a bunch of chicks, and I started getting high, and I just didn't want to work as a cop anymore. It was a very stupid period of my life, but I'm glad it was, because I quit the police department and moved out to California, because my whole band had moved to California because they were all going to make believe they're going to college. And that sounded like a great idea to me. You know, nothing like getting money from the folks and make believe you're going to school. Hey, this is a great life, you know? So I did that for a while, and I was down in Southern California. Then I decided, I got real sick of that. I put my thumb out one day, and I moved up to Berkeley, California, and I lived up there for about 18 or 19 years. I started my own band. I had a group called the Rockets, and the original lead guitar player was a guitar player that played with John Lee Hooker, so the band was very blues-orientated. It was a lot of fun. We used to do a lot of great songs, and we got another, just like the old Joe Cavaliero days, we auditioned for CBS, and they liked me, but they didn't like the band, and I said to myself, I'm not going to make the same mistake twice. So I started Eddie Money and the New Rockets, and I got Jimmy Lyon to play guitar for me. He was only 17 years old at the time. And we had written Baby Hold On and Two Tickets to Paradise and Jealousies, and we were signed by Bill Graham. I got signed at Sounds of the City. Sounds of the City, I was one of the first bands to ever get a record deal off a videotape. We got to play at Winterland, which is where greats like, you know, The Cream played and Jimi Hendrix and, you know, a lot of great acts, and they said, well, you won. I said, well, Mr. Graham, what did they win? What did I win? He said, well, you got to play Winterland. I said, have you ever seen this place with the lights on? This place is a dump. I need a deal.
Is it true you might want a better life? Is it true you think that-
And I had written Two Ticks Paradise and Baby Hold On, and I got a deal. See, Bill Graham signed me. I've been through a lot of changes. I've been through, like, you know, five old ladies, God knows how many cars, God knows how many houses, but I still basically have the same friends, and I'm still doing the same thing. The funny thing about that whole album, the first record, is that Baby Hold On was a huge hit, and I went on tour for about, Bill Graham has been my manager, and I went on tour opening up Santana and everybody in the world. I was on tour opening up Steve Miller. I was on tour opening up even the Rolling Stones, a lot of great, great artists. And I came back, and Baby Hold On was number four on the charts, and everybody was like, the red carpet was out for me. I thought that Paul McCartney was standing behind me. I want to hit L.A. because I had no idea that the record has gotten did as well as it did, because I wasn't aware of the fact that I was becoming famous, because I was just seeing hotel rooms and gigs and working my butt off at doing what I love to do. But I had no idea that my career just catapulted to the amount that it did. I started playing sax junior college in Oakland, California. My sax teacher's name was Mr. Diamante. I'll never forget him. He was a great jazz horn player from the 40s. And I never really played the horn, but I always thought that the saxophone was the extension of the human voice. Because, like, David Bowie, I thought, at one time was a great horn player. Van Morrison used to play saxophone, you know? And, like, I thought they were both really good horn players, and they stopped playing. So I told the sax teacher that I took saxophone lessons in a marching band, which I never did. And it took me, like, 3 weeks to learn the C scale. And then I get in there and audition to join this class, and the guy took me on. And I started playing the horn day and night. I mean, I'd have that horn around me all the time because I love to play saxophone. It was so much fun. As a matter of fact, when we toured with the Rolling Stones, the sax player got sick. Bobby Keys, he wasn't available for the show we did in Louisville, Kentucky. And Mick Jagger says to me, "Hey, Eddie, do you know Miss You?" I said, "Hey, Mick, I wrote it." And I got up there and I played Miss You on horn with the Rolling Stones. And that was the night they were on the King Biscuit Hour. I love playing saxophone. It's a great instrument to play. It goes over great live, and it's just a lot of fun, you know? Well, you know what? When I wrote Wanna Be a Rock and Roll Star, it's a funny story about that, because if you listen to the lyrics, the song is it's an interview put to music. Ever since I was young, I'd sing and I'd hum those crazy songs I heard on the radio. My mother would jump and shout and say, "What's that noise about?" and quietly turn the dial back to her stations, you know? It's kind of like, if you listen to the entire song, it's like me giving an interview of my past life and what I want, you know what I mean? Like, I saw so many people like Montrose and Sammy Haggard and a group called Earthquake, and a lot of people get signed around me, and I'm going to myself, you know, what's happening here? Do you know, actually, after Janis Joplin died, I was the first singer to sing with Big Brother and the Holding Company. Yeah, before, and then Nick Ravenitis didn't like me. I was young, I was skinny, I had a great voice, and I was crushed when I lost the gig to him. And I had a lot of rejection in my life, and I thought I had the goods because I had a great rock band in high school. I had a great rock band in junior high school. I became a good singer because that's all I really did was sing day and night. And I wanted what I thought I justly deserved. As a matter of fact, I dropped out of college. I went to every different community college you can think of. Then I was studying at Berkeley for a while, and I wasn't doing, my grades stunk. And then I went back to Laney College in Oakland, which is just a little funky school. And I started taking music lessons. I took voice. I took saxophone. I retook piano. I took piano in grammar school, and I got back into my piano playing because I got tired of singing everybody else's songs. I wanted to write my own songs. Like, I was singing with a group called the Rockets. Dan Alexander was the former guitar player from the John Lee Hooker band. He was the lead guitar player, and his girlfriend was Martha Davis from the Motels, and she didn't like him anymore, and he was totally rejected, and I was singing all these songs about him having a broken heart, and every song he did was in the key of E because it was open tuning, and I'd be screaming my lungs out trying to hit these notes because, you know, I was forced to do other people's material. And I said to myself, this isn't going to work for me. So I started writing my own songs. I took voice lessons from a lady named Judy Davis, who's a great voice coach. She taught people like Frank Sinatra, Barbara Streisand, Vicky Carr, Sammy Davis, and I took lessons from her, private lessons from her, for 3 or 4 years. All of a sudden, for the first time in my life, I was an A student because I was taking things that I really wanted to take. I was learning more about what I wanted to do, more about my craft. I started looking at rock and roll as not like it's a side job. I looked at it as something that I, as a profession, something I wanted to do. I would play like top 40 clubs during the week. One minute I have to do John Fogerty. The next minute I'd have to imitate Stevie Wonder. I would learn how to bend my voice up in so many different ways. That's how I developed my style. And then on the weekends, I would play clubs like the Keystone Berkeley, the Long Branch. And I started really meeting people like the Tubes, meeting people like Patti Smith, got friends with Sammy Hagar, and everything started happening, and I wanted a deal. And I was preparing myself on a professional level, taking great voice lessons, taking really good courses in school, that I started looking at it as a profession. It's something that I really wanted to be, and I wanted to be a rock and roll star. I wanted a house on the hills. Because, you know, when I quit the police department, my parents was so heartbroken. And when I moved out to California, started smoking pot, growing my hair long, and you know, just having a blast, you know, I felt so guilty because of that Irish Catholic guilt that was brought up on me, that I was on the dean's list and I was doing great in school, but my parents cut me off. So then I got a job at JCPenney's, which was horrible. I was the receiving clerk, which wasn't a bad job until I had that white sheet sale. You know how many sheets? I've never seen so many sheets in my life. I mean, I thought I was going to die of a double hernia. So I just said to myself, I got to get into something that I'm... The only thing I was really good at was singing rock and roll. So that's when I really, you know, after I got rejected by CBS twice, after playing on the Rolling Stones equipment and not getting the deal, I just got tired. I just said, look, I'm good. I wrote 2 Tickets to Paradise. I started writing songs. But Wanna Be a Rock and Roll Song was the first rock and roll song that I ever really took seriously when I wrote.
We'll be right back.
We did a gig at in the Aleutian Islands for the Eskimos in the Aleutian Islands, which is the islands off the coast of Alaska. And now when Reagan and the Russians started making up these imaginary boundary lines, the Eskimos, these little fishing villages, all of a sudden they were separated from their families and everything else because of these imaginary boundaries by Russia and the United States. I did a benefit for the Eskimos up there in the Aleutian Islands, and we played with some really great Russian musicians. And at the end of the night, we jammed, and we did the song that they wanted to do, which is Back in the USSR, and I taught them Wanna Be a Rock and Roll Star. And then when we got to the bridge, I sang, I wanna be a rock and roll star! And I pointed to the Russian guy, and he said, I want to drive a big black car! So, you know, the song still rings true to me, because a lot of young people these days, they don't want to grow up to be the president of the United States. They don't want to grow up to be a nuclear scientist. They want to grow up to be rock and roll stars, and they want to grow up to be ball players. And it still holds true that if you really, this is the greatest country in the world, and if you really believe in your dreams, no matter what it is, and you stick to them, there's a very good chance, a stronger chance than any other country in the world, that your dreams
come
true.
Coming up next, Eddie Money's dreams do come true, only to swirl into a real-life nightmare which almost killed him. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and explore many more of your favorite rocker musician interviews at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Eddie Money in the studio.
Welcome back. This is the Money Man. That's right, Eddie Money with Redbeard in the studio.
Thank you, Eddie. In retrospect, that 1977 debut album by Eddie Money received a remarkable amount of U.S. radio airplay for an unknown. The production by veteran Doors engineer Bruce Botnick was straightforward but sturdy. The musicians were a tasty mix of veterans and newcomers, but the choice of songs was very strong, even Eddie Money's choice of a Motown classic to cover.
You know, my father always told me that if you can't hum a tune, you know, you won't ever really make any money on it. You know, to me, I think that melody lines are such an important aspect of writing, you know what I mean? And you have to really have something to say. I don't really do that many cover songs. One of the only cover songs I ever did was Really Got a Hold on Me. I started, you know, when I first started the first Eddie Money record, I had songs like Wanna Be a Rock and Roll Star. I had songs like Baby Hold On. I had songs like Two Tickets to Paradise. But I got in the studio with people like Gary Malibu and Lonnie Turner, who were the rhythm section for the Steve Miller Band, who I think was one of the greatest artists in the world, especially albums like, you know, Children of the Future and stuff like that. You know, just a great, great, great writer. And when I started in the studio with them, they had the red light on, and they were doing my songs. And Jimmy Lyon and myself had worked very hard, playing day and night, you know, playing every rock club in the world, you know, thinking someday that we might, you know, make a living at what we were doing. And when the red light was on, they were just kind of like breezing through my stuff, and I just didn't really appreciate it. So I was very worried about my career at that time, and I decided that we would start off with something that everybody is familiar with and change it around and twist it into Eddie Money. And we picked an old R&B song written by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, You Really Got a Hold on Me. And I did it more in the vein that a Steve Miller would do it in, you know, because when you went and go, hold me, squeeze me, hold me, squeeze me, because I thought that was kind of corny. So I just did something, the progression was, I went, hold me, hold me, just one, two, three, and you're there.
Got a hold on me, I don't wanna kiss you. but I just can't quit now, 'cause you really got a hold on me. Really got a hold on me. You really got a hold on me. Really got a hold.
Just another example of why Eddie Money's 1977 debut earns no less than a 4.5 stars out of 5 review on AllMusic.com. With such strong initial support, Eddie Money's late manager, concert promoter, legend Bill Graham sent the singer and his band out on the road, from which they rarely returned.
74 shows in 42 cities, boy, I'll tell you, in 91 days. I remember that so well. The funniest thing about that thing is I did that whole tour, that first tour, opening up everybody in the world. Van Halen opened me up in Canada, and they were becoming really super big, but I was the headlining group, and it was about 20 below zero, and their name was ahead of mine on the Billboard. And I didn't care if they were bigger than me. I was the top act. I had my roadies go out and change the sign, put me back on top, and then I spelt their name wrong underneath. No, I mean, I did a lot of work. And the thing is like, I finally got back to San Francisco, which is where I was living at the time, after the whole tour was over. And they put this big postcard up in the lobby, this big, huge postcard, Eddie Money's back, and everybody and all my fans came down to see me and stuff like that. And it was like a big welcome home party for Eddie Money. And I was only home for like a day and a half. I didn't even stay in my house. And then I went back out on the road. It was so bizarre. I worked really hard, but, you know, that's when Baby Hold On and Two Tickets, that's when the first record really happened. Now the album, you know, the record, it's a double platinum album going on 3 million units. But it was a lot of hard work, and it all paid off, but it was a lot of fun, too.
Does anybody recollect? out to me. Ooh, can't remember if you don't hear it no more. Someone don't play it, you'll forget it for sure. I can't take it no more. I can't take it no more.
Eddie Money's Get a Move On comes from his follow-up to the 3 million-selling debut, 1978's Life for the Taking. But in those halcyon days, we were beginning to see the rock and roll recklessness taking life as well, including the biggest icon of them all.
Well, you know what happened? I was in the studio making the record, and I used to love early, you know, like Love Me Tender days. I loved early Elvis Presley, you know, the Don't Be Cruel days, the All Shook Up days, you know. Heartbreak Hotel. I mean, he was the greatest. Then he started making those crummy, horrible movies. And I fell out of Elvis, but I always had in the back of my mind that love that I had for Elvis, the Elvis I knew was the young Elvis, you know? You know, when my mind would go blank when I'd see those movies, you know, in the drive-in. They were just a horror show completely. But when he passed away, it kind of put me in shock. I thought it was a very sad thing, you know, to lose such a great, to lose the king. He was the king of rock and roll. And John Lennon thought he was the king too, which is very crazy. It's the same thing. It was very heartbreaking to lose the real great Beatle too. When John Lennon passed away, I was just stunned, you know. It was just, also on that album was also dedicated to a guy named David Horowitz.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
David Horowitz was a very good friend of mine, and he played the original keyboards in the musical Tommy that was originally done in San Francisco. He was a great keyboard player. He had a great organ that he let me use. He had a great PA system that he let me use. And he was just a real character. He wasn't much of a lawyer, but he was a great rock and roller. And the shocking thing about it is that he died of a drug overdose. I just couldn't believe it, you know. He died from doing too much cocaine and his heart stopped or something. And I wasn't really into blow in those days because, number one, it was just too expensive. I'm being honest. And I never really got into crack either because, you know, when I was doing cocaine, you know, people used to just sniff it and snort it. But then when they started melting it down at the rocks and stuff, it would cost so much money before it hit the streets, and now it's like a ghetto drug. But, you know, it was really expensive to take like a quarter ounce of cocaine and get like, you know, 2 grams worth of it out. You know, I was always too cheap to do expensive drugs like that. But thank God, that's probably why I'm still alive today. But the thing is, that same album, you started to realize that drugs were not happening because I lost David Horowitz, who was a real great guy. It was just a shame to lose that because at the same time, Tom Petty was just starting to happen too. And David would have loved to seen the success that he really helped me get. And I was really heavily stricken by his death. It just really, it hurt me tremendously. And then when Elvis passed away, that, you know, it took me a long time to put two and two together. Like, you know, I was so stupid. Drugs are no good. But then again, I was always on the road and I never really got into, I used to like to drink. I was always a beer drinker and vodka and tonic. And then I started doing cocaine just enough so I could keep drinking. That's what I did. I did blow so I could stay drunk. And then after a while, I just said, this is just not happening. It's bad for my audience. You know, I started meeting some really horrible people that did nothing but use me. And I had to pack it in, man. I feel so much better today.
Ages, and it's magic.
Trinidad comes from Eddie Money's Playin' for Keeps album in 1980. Still to come, Eddie Money overdraws on his American Excess account. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and get exclusive rock musician interviews at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Eddie Money for the 30th anniversary of the platinum No Control.
Hi gang, this is Money Man. That's right, Eddie Money in the studio for No Control with Redbeard in the studio. You know, the first time I heard my record on the radio, I was super choked up. I was like, it was Baby Hold On. And I was, you know, I mean, tears came to my eyes. And the first thing I did, my parents told me I would never make it. And I called my mother at home and I was, Mom, I'm on the radio. And she said, Eddie, I told you not to call me on Mahjong night, which was, she was playing cards with her girlfriends, you know. It was a bizarre night. But the second time I heard it on a jukebox. I had become so famous. And things were getting really bizarre because, you know, I don't like being that famous. I don't like going to a restaurant where everybody's staring at me eat. It's, you know, like going to a ball game and wind up signing autographs, you know, all the way up to the seventh inning stretch. It just gets a little bizarre. I mean, I like fans, but I like fans that, I don't really call my fans fans. I'm not a Michael Jackson. I'm not a George Michael. I mean, I've never had a bodyguard or anything else like that. I've never passed on giving an autograph up or anything like that. But the first time I heard it on the jukebox, I was in my favorite bar where I play Liar's Dice, and everybody in there either works on the post office or they're welders or, you know, and everybody plays, you know, pool in there and stuff like that. And it was just the guys, you know. They, you know, I had a softball team I was on there, and nobody really treated me like a rock star. And then Baby Hold On came on the jukebox, and I was drinking, and I picked up a chair and put it right through the jukebox. I was so, I said, this guy is driving me crazy. You know, it just came to the point where I just, of course, the vodka might have had a little something to do with it at the time. But, you know, it's a point where you've got to separate yourself from being Eddie Money and Eddie Mahoney. You know what I mean? Like, I love my job, but I it gets to the point where I don't, you know, you just, it just gets crazy, you know? I mean, it's like when I go out to parties, or when I go out to a ball game, or if I go to a concert, you spend so much time, you know, being nice to people you don't know, and it's fantastic. I mean, I owe this to them because, you know, they're the ones that bought my records. They're the ones that put me in this position that I'm in. But a lot of times I like to go unnoticed. I like to just be myself. You know what I mean? I like to just hang out with the guys and you know, just, you know, I don't like really being in the limelight that much, you know?
Eddie Money's song Shaken comes from his fourth album, 1982's No Control, but it was a miracle that Eddie was even alive to make it.
Well, the early after playing for Keeps is when I had when I had what they call the accident, which really really wasn't an accident. It was a drug overdose. When I made the first two albums, I was on the road all the time. I had no home life at all. Then I made Playing for Keeps with Ron Neverson, and he's changed his tune a lot. He's become a great. I think that was at the bottom of his career too when we made Playing for Keys, because it was very over budget. He was a very sick man at the time, but at the same time, it gave me the opportunity to be in one location for a long period of time. I was staying at the Chateau Marmont with, you know, like Belushi and Ricky Lee Jones band, and also a lot of great people, and I was doing a lot of heavy partying, you know, and but it gave me the opportunity. Like, I had one girlfriend in Northern California and I had another girlfriend down here. I was wrecking Cadillacs and just, I was really going out and partying extensively because Ron would never show up for work. And that's when I started getting into heavy drugs. I was young, I had really long hair, I was really good looking, and well, at least that's what the girls thought. I mean, I turned around, I was this big sex symbol, you know, and instead of carrying my own equipment and fighting with club owners, all of a sudden people were saying I was famous, so to speak. So I used that to my advantage, and I was getting in a lot of fights, and I was very bitter about playing for keeps not happening. And I finally got back to Northern California where I was living, and my girlfriend had left me, and at that time, I had a new girlfriend, and I was doing a lot of heavy drinking, and one night I went out to a so-called friend of mine. He wasn't really a friend at all, and I thought I was snorting some blow because I was, you know, I was really drunk and I wanted to drive home, and it turned out to be a phenytoin, which is a bathtub barbiturate, and it knocked me out, put me into a coma, and I went into a coma on my leg, and the nerve felt, the sciatic nerve on my left leg fell asleep, and it knocked out the sciatic nerve, which is the longest nerve in your body. It goes from your hip to your leg. And all I know is I woke up, you know, with tubes coming out of me, and I woke up and I tried to crawl out of the hospital because I was due to do Trinidad on solid gold. of course, I never made it. Trinidad would have been a great, great hit single for that record to turn the whole thing around. And I was determined to, be, you know, because I was always very popular on the road due to AOR radio and due to my reputation. Naturally, Trinidad didn't happen, and the record sales were really bad. And then the doctors told me I was never going to walk again. And I couldn't believe it. I said, well, who's going to pay the bills if I never want? And like, I was giving up for dead. I had a 40% chance of living, no less walking. And when I got out of the hospital, I spent about a year and a half of really so much therapy. It was crazy. Unfortunately, I didn't take any mental therapy. I just took physical therapy because I went back out after that. And when I made the album No Control, Tom Dowd was a great producer. And I had this one guy come over and twist me up like a pretzel and work on my leg and try to get the blood thrown, try to get me to move my toes and stuff like that. And it was a very long, hard, tragic road. When I wrote the album No Control, I used to walk with a walker, like a little old lady, a walker from my bedroom to the music room to write that album. And then I finally started walking again, and before I knew it, I started, you know, one day I decided to run on the beach, and everybody was just so flipped out. And, you know, the thing is, like, I wasn't going to let people tell me that I was never going to walk again. And because, you know, I wanted to, you know, I had a very strong constitution, and I wanted to, not only did I want to walk again, I wanted to dance again. And people said it was impossible, you know. And I had a miraculous comeback, you know. And I want to thank God for that. And I want to thank my ex-wife for that. And I want to thank CBS Records for still standing behind me. And Bill Graham was still a great manager. And it was a really tough period in my life. It really was.
Tonight.
Think I'm in Love from 1982's No Control album was the return of Eddie Money to the top of the charts. The advent of MTV at that time in America allowed Eddie to remain in the public eye without touring, which was impossible while he was recovering from the partial paralysis, which forced Eddie to use a walker to get around.
When we made No Control, they said the record would never go platinum. And I said, I'll bet you $500 that record goes platinum, because I had so many fans out there. Now, Shaken wasn't really a big hit. It only got to number 66 on the CHR charts, but everybody in the world knows Shaken. And songs like No Control, I mean, I'd play No Control live, and I was the man with No Control. This was before Guns N' Roses, and this was before a lot of people that think they get out there. I mean, I was, you know, the guy that could stay up longer than anybody, drink anybody under the table, have more girlfriends than anybody else, and still get out there and do a dynamite show and get four encores. And people couldn't understand it. But this is my will. This was just this Eddie Money character that I used to let out of a cage. Like my mother calls me the Dorian Gray of rock and roll.
And I swore I wouldn't go. My blood was running much too high. My heart was much too slow. The doctor had some questions, some things he had to know. My lady shook her head and said, the bullet's got no control. Well, I wasn't born in trouble. My adopted middle name. When you're running with the devil, we'll be right back.
is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest Eddie Money. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2012, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Continue to follow In the Studio on Facebook. And for this and many more interviews and live performances by the biggest names in rock, visit inthestudio.net.